One of our greatest treasures and tourist attractions is the Book of Kells, which is housed in Trinity College. But despite its fame, it's not well understood, as we're very removed from the circumstances of its creation. Also, it's written in Latin. That's another barrier to understanding the text. And then there's figuring out how the beautiful images work with the words. Well, I have my hands now on a new book, beautiful new book, the brainchild of Bernard Meehan, head of research collections and keeper of manuscripts at Trinity College Library. The Book of Kells is a guide to its background and to its major artistic themes. Bernard, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you very
much. That's
a
beautiful production.
It is. I'm very pleased with it. It looks great.
I have at home an earlier facsimile of the Book of Kells produced maybe 20 years ago.
You probably have the François Henri book that was done in 1974, and that's been out of print for some time now.
Produced
by the same publisher, but this one is, I think the pages look better in this.
Yeah, printing technology has advanced.
Oh, it's all advanced, yeah.
Pace. Now, tell us, first of all, who wrote it, why, where?
Well, we don't know precisely who wrote it. It's one of the big problems with the Book of Kells, that we don't really know a great deal about it with any certainty at all, so that the study of the book is a study of a number of uncertainties. But it's linked with Kells from the 11th century. It's very likely that part, at least, of it was written in Kells in County Meath. It's possible that it was begun in Iona, which is now in Argyllshire in Scotland, but at the time, and we're talking around the year 800, was Irish territory. A foundation of St. Columbkill coming from Donegal in the 6th century.
So if it was commenced there, and I believe the original book might have been gilt, in fact, with literally gold ornamentation around it, physical gold.
Well, the book itself has no gold. The pages themselves have no gold. But there was a cover at one time that was stolen in the 11th century that certainly was gold.
Never to be seen again. Melted down, probably.
Probably.
So why was it moved from Iona to Kells? We can only speculate.
We can speculate that that Iona was a very good situation in terms of arable land and for transport around the various islands and between Ireland and what is now Scotland. But it was also very vulnerable to Viking attacks. And the community certainly moved at some point in the early 9th century from Iona itself to Kells, probably for a number of reasons. But what's most commonly said is it's for reasons of safety.
Safety to keep not just this book, but presume other artefacts that the monks had.
Yes, and to preserve their own lives, because quite large numbers of them were killed. We know from the Annals of Ulster, we know that they were killed in Viking attacks.
So in terms of any analysis scientific of the makeup of the book, can we tell how much of it was written in the 9th century, how much later on?
Well, one of the big problems with the book is that it's very clearly discontinuous. It doesn't take place in a single phase of production. There are different scribes, there are different artists, and what is clear is that there are certain artists are coming along and certain scribes finishing off the work of others.
You see the discontinuity in style, for example?
You can see a discontinuity in style. What you can see with one of the scribes particularly is that he very much likes to fill spaces. He has a horror of the open page, and so he repeats words and he does scrolling.
So he's almost doodling, filling up the page.
He's filling up the page, yes.
Now, there were some blank pages, and they used them for a most bizarre activity, did they not? To record land purchases or something at the back of the book.
Oh, yeah, well, that was quite common in medieval manuscripts associated with a particular house, that they would use... They would record land grants in what was their most prized possession. They would use that to validate their
so it seems like it's almost sacrilegious to us that they'd be putting these commoner garden transactions in such a sacred text. But that was the
possibly,
dumb thing.
But that was normal.
Yeah. Now, what is in the Book of Kells? What texts do we find?
The principal texts are copies of the four Gospels, There are other preliminary abbreviations of the text in the at the beginning of the book, but what we basically have is a copy of the four Gospels, very richly decorated with pages of full pages of ornament showing the evangelist symbols, showing the opening words of text and some very key passages of text. But these are the pages that everyone sees in reproduction very commonly. But those are only a handful of pages among the 680 that survive. So it's a very large book and it's very, very richly decorated.
How would it have been used by the monks?
That we're not certain about. It must have been used for special occasions. I expect it was processed around the church in special occasions. I think it was very likely it was used on the altar and used in a way that that the rest of the community could read it or could see it or could tell from what the decoration was, what the text was going to be. We've lost some of our understanding of how this worked, I think.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that your book investigates, is what the meaning of a picture, and particularly some artistic motif that is repeated. It was a shorthand.
There's a kind of background rhythm of decoration going through the book where the Eucharist in all its forms, grapes and chalices particularly, is repeated absolutely throughout the book. And then there are other places where certain gospel incidents are shown. I mean, one of the ones that that had been seen as whimsical at times in the past, but really was quite purposeful in terms of the decoration, was that the journey of Jesus into Jerusalem is shown twice, and once you see it, and once you recognise that it's in the middle of that particular text, its meaning becomes very, very clear, in a way that certainly to me was not clear until quite recently, but must have been absolutely clear at the time.
You have new examples of what you called concealed illustrations, which you found. Which it's extraordinary to find new things. It must be very exciting. Jesus riding into Jerusalem on the back of a donkey. Judas's betrayal.
Yeah, Judas's betrayal is something that was quite exciting to to catch sight of a year or maybe 2 years ago, where I was going through the text trying to relate the some aspects of the decoration to the text itself. And suddenly realised that the two lions embracing each other at the beginning of the passage in which Judas approaches Jesus with soldiers, that this is representing not simply two lions for the sake of showing two lions, but it's representing Judas betraying Jesus with a kiss. And it's extremely close, I then realised, to a representation of what is probably the same incident on the market cross at Kells itself, and it's a very, very common thing to see in gospel books of the period.
So things that we might see as whimsical almost, if you see a peacock or a snake, it has an absolutely precise meaning.
Yeah, the peacock and the snake are both symbols of rebirth and resurrection. There was a belief that the peacock's flesh didn't putrefy. With the snake, of course, the snake sloughs off its skin and develops a new life. So these become very potent symbols of Christ's resurrection, and they're repeated as a reminder to the faithful and to the monks throughout the book.
The Star of Bethlehem, you discovered it.
Yeah, I think I've discovered it. At the point where there's an image of the Virgin and Child, one of the angels is holding up what looks like the Star of Bethlehem, and then on the facing page, where there's a brief account of Christ's nativity, again, the Star of Bethlehem is shown pretty well throughout. It's extremely like an unmistakable representation of the same thing on an 8th century casket in England.
It is extraordinary that at this remove, you know, the book has been studied by so many people over the years, that there are still secrets to be found.
Oh, and there are still things to be found. You know, I think that I don't think there's any single overarching theory is going to radically change our view of the book. It may do, but what I think we do is try to pick away at the edges of the whole subject. That it's we're never going to get precisely to where they were, because I think that in terms of our backgrounds and the way that we live, we've really come too far to be able to do that.
We use all sorts of shorthand ourselves. I mean, the best example of it in contemporary life is texting,
Sure.
Where we use text speak shorthand. And someone, for example, in the 16th century looking at 21st century text speak would wonder what the hell it was.
Mm.
And yet, to our eyes, it's very simple to just decipher. You have devices, you've discovered artistic devices within the text to draw attention, for example, to Jesus' direct speech.
Mm, Jesus' direct speech is shown in a number of ways. In one particular case, there's something very like modern quotation marks, but what is more common is that there are lines drawn in a very extravagant way at the beginning of initials, and frequently they point to their mouths. You know, in making up words like dicket, he said, or iet, which again means he said. And this is a kind of shorthand for people possibly who could not read the word dicket, but they would know that this indicated what was to follow.
Other ideas, for example, the spirals that appear. You suggest, or someone else has suggested, I think, that this may have been produced almost as a precursor to printing, winding a wire, a spiral of wire, and stamping it down just to save time and trouble to produce an identical spiral.
I think the difficulty with the very, very tight spirals is that they're beyond the resolution of the human eye. And Joseph Batley, who's a Spanish calligrapher, has come up with the idea, which I think, bears repeating, that that these people were extreme. The whole culture that they came from, they were very, very good at fine metalwork, and they were technically very capable of producing this very tightly wound wire, which they would then ink and stamp. And it's the uneven placing of them on the page that particularly suggested to him that this was what was happening.
That was happening. It's absolutely fascinating. The Book of Kells by Bernard is published by Thames and Hudson. The cost, do you know? Whatever it is worth it.
It's €75.
Yeah, fabulous book, fabulous book. By the way, the notion that a virtual version of the Book of Kells will actually be available in Kells, are you across that project? No,
you're ahead of me there, I think.
Yeah, and I read a report of the weekend suggesting that rather than have the Book of Kells, which they want back in Kells, that they might get a digital version that tourists could come along and just...
Well, there is a digital version, and that was on display in Kells, I think.
All right, so there we go. All right, Bernard, thank you very much for joining us. As I say, a wonderful book, expensive, but probably the ideal Christmas present for somebody you know. That's